evening. Welcome to Donnell Edwards Viewpoints on the CWR Network. And I am your host, Donnell Edwards. We welcome all of our listeners in CWR Nation here in the United States, as well as our international audience in Canada, the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, Australia, Argentina, and wherever else in the world you may be listening. We thank you. Tonight's special guest is author, speaker, and activist, Mrs. Chandra Brooks, who is the Northern California State Director for Service Employees International Union, United Service Workers West. Her passion is community, civil rights, social justice, and improving voter outcomes and civic engagement in communities of color. Chandra is the former Vice President of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Executive Director of Building Peaceful Families, co-founder of Women Get It Done, Silicon Valley, and graduate of Emerge California, a political training program for Democratic women. She is also Vice Chair of Santa Clara County's Commission on the Status of Women and Girls, and co-chair of the Crime and Violence Committee that manages the Commission's oversight of Elmwood's Women's Correctional Facility, and most recently joining the ACLU Lead California Police Accountability and Transparency Coalition. In 2013, Chandra received the Portrait of Success Award from the Hispanic Development Corporation, and in 2014, the Activist of the Year Award from Latinos Action Media. In 2015, Chandra was named one of the most influential women in Silicon Valley from the Silicon Valley Business Journal, and was inducted into the Eastside Unified High School District Hall of Fame. And in 2016, she was named Woman of the Year from 100 Black Women of Silicon Valley. Please join me in welcoming to Donnell Edwards Viewpoints the dynamic Mrs. Chandra Brooks.
Your book Black, Brown, and Political, Get Informed, Get Empowered, and Change the Game. And it's an Amazon bestseller.
Yes,
congratulations. Now, the
Thank
book,
you.
You're very welcome. According to your press release, the book serves as a handbook for those who want to understand how to become engaged in their local communities through civic engagement and community development. Now, that's very interesting. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, so thank you for having me, Donnell, on the show. I appreciate it. And yes, so for the book, it started as an idea, and me being an activist and somebody involved in politics locally within my city, I was getting phone calls from family and friends when it was election time on who to vote for. People would call me the mayor. That was my nickname, the governor, because I was so involved in local politics. And what I noticed is that family and friends and just people within my circle didn't know anything about who the mayor was, really, who city council, their local area, what a state assembly member, was, and, who was their congressional representative. They didn't know any of that. The only thing they really knew was what Trump was doing and, what they show on TV and television, and that's usually national politics. And so I really seen how local politics affects us faster and sooner and how much power we really had. So I said, I'm going to do a book because I think this is so important, because usually the people that are elected at the local levels usually work their way up, and they, they start locally and then they go to state, a state representative, and then they go to congressional races, and then eventually maybe to be the president of the United States, so higher office. So it's very important on who we elect locally, because they're going to continue to run for office. So if we pick the right people, and if we're really strategic and really engaged in what's going on, we can really have an effect on what happens in the future of politics. So that's kind of where the book came about, and I wanted to make it very simple, no political jargon, no confusion, something somebody could read in an hour and sit there and be kind of a light bulb come on, wow, we have more power than we think we do, and hopefully ignite something inside of them to get started and get active within their community.
Okay. So the book is literally a handbook or a guide for anyone mm-hmm. that wants to become more involved in the community. That's great. So how long have you been involved in civic activity?
I would say 20 years,
okay.
or a little under, maybe 18 to 20 years. I'm 40 years old. I turned 40 this year, and I started getting active, you know, when I was about 20. So,
okay.
It's been a while.
All right. Very, very good. So you're speaking from someone who has a lot of experience. So that's great.
Oh, yeah.
Now, obviously, what we're going to be talking about tonight is, you know, race relations and where they are. And obviously, all one has to do is to open their eyes and ears to understand that race relations in America can be described as volatile, powder keg just waiting to explode. So what I would like to do tonight is to discuss some of the causes for the explosive racial climate in America. And at the top of my list, you already kind of mentioned it, is the current president of the United States and his administration. It's interesting that according to an article in Yahoo News from November 15th of this year, entitled Hate in America, Where It Comes From and Why It's Back, written by Andrew Romano and Lisa Belkin, referred to October 19th date when former President George W. Bush traveled to New York City to deliver a speech at an event dedicated to the spirit of liberty at home in the world. And quoting former President Bush, he said, "We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. Bigotry seems emboldened," end of quote. Now, Chandra, in your opinion, does former President Bush's comments in that article indicate that the current president, Donald Trump, has fanned the flames and emboldened racists and racist organizations to be more emboldened to openly and often violently attack people of color and anyone else whom they disapprove of?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I think they have a representative now and somebody at the top of the food chain, basically, right? Or our leader of this country who is giving them the green light to you know, ignite and to really express themselves the way they wanted to. I think they were in the shadows before, but I think now they feel that they have somebody who will stand up for them and somebody that will defend them. And they feel more powerful, especially when they see this person that is a leader of our country that, you know, kind of represents what they stand for in a way.
Okay.
So I think that, yeah, I think that they do. They, you know, I think it's they're in the shadows and now they're able to come out and be more open with it. So I definitely agree with the former president's statement.
Okay. Now, an example of the outgrowth of what's happened under the Trump presidency is the emboldening of the white nationalists and others is what happened in Charlottesville, which most people listening are familiar with. And on that Friday, August 11th, as part of a Unite the Right rally at the University of Virginia, several hundred white nationalists and white supremacists marched to protest the removal of a statue of Confederate icon General Robert E. Lee. And all the while they were chanting, "White Lives Matter, You Will Not Replace Us, and Jews Will Not Replace Us." The rally the next day, as we all know, on that Saturday, August 12th, resulted in violence and three deaths. Now, Chandra, just who are these white nationalists and white supremacists, and how are they different?
You know what? I've seen videos of that. And it's so painful watching it, and it just hurt my heart to watch that. But I think what that ignited, you know, I think it's been several things that have ignited their they feel threatened, right? And the statements they're making, "You will not replace us," "Jews will not replace us," "You will not replace us." and White Lives Matter. You know, these are all, you know, statements of people that feel like, okay, we're losing our power. What's going on here? You know, because we, you know, people of color are rising. We're figuring out our rights. We are, you know, we are getting educated and understanding, and we're fighting back more than ever. And I think that they're scared, and they're really scared that they are going to be replaced. So I think the men that came out, or the individuals that came out that day, are people that are, you know, insecure, and insecure white people that have felt a certain type of way for a long time in their families, because they've been taught this type of ideals and this belief. And now they feel that they can have a voice and say how they feel. But I really feel it's people that are scared and that are threatened. And this is the statements they want to use, but it is all fear statements. It's all statements of insecurity. And I think that that's who they are. These are people, but they have these fears and insecurities, but they also feel like they have a voice now, and they're not going to be punished if they speak up and use their voice.
Okay, that's an interesting point, because that's exactly what's driving a lot of this, because they know, as you mentioned, they have a friend, and it trickles down from the top. And there are other people now in powerful positions who have positions that would allow them to make sure that these people do not get punished for what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that we wanted to talk about, too, that we view as a cause of the current racial divide is white privilege. You hear a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
Some people may not know what it is. But in 1988, Professor Peggy McIntosh used the paper White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack, to describe white privilege as a set of unearned assets that a white person in America can count on cashing in each day, but to which they remain largely oblivious. Do you agree with the professor's definition of white privilege, and how does that contribute to the current racial divide in America?
Yes, I definitely agree with it. And that's exactly, I mean, I seen your question, and I was ready to say the exact same thing that Peggy said, that it's an invisible package of unearned assets. And, you know, I've done a lot of work in different, you know, with white people on this, and white allies that, you know, understand their white privilege. So I've seen white people that understand their white privilege, and I mean, and I've worked with people that do not understand it. And they're totally oblivious, don't get it, feel they don't have it. And they're just like, I love everybody and I don't see color. And, you know, and that actually, that statement is part of white privilege when people say that I see no color. I have black friends, and, you know, those statements that people make. But just because you have black friends and you don't see color doesn't mean you don't have white privilege. White privilege is not something you're taking. It's something that was given. It's unearned. It's something that you just you had when you were born. And understanding that, even some of the even white people that have grown up in the inner cities have white privilege. So making people understand that just because of the color of your skin, you have a privilege in society, and understanding the difference between, okay, you might not be racist, you might have black friends, you might not see color, but still understanding that. And I think the white allies and the people that are doing the great work in the communities, which are white, the ones that really understand it, is so important, because they need to be educating their other white family and friends to make it very clear, because I think people really get defensive when they hear that statement. So definitely, I definitely agree with it. I definitely feel that the part that it's playing in today's society is also helpful, because it's white people are rising up now. And I think white people are starting to get educated about it, because they didn't really know about it. I think we've known about it for a while, white privilege, and we've seen it as people of color. We've seen it every day. But I think white people are just getting, they're just getting educated about what white privilege is, and they've had it their whole life. So how would you feel if you had something your whole life and other people were trying to educate you about it. So I think that we have to be understanding in that way as well. It's going to take some time for some people to come to the point where they own it. And they say, okay, I own it. I know it's there. I want to help. I want to do something about it.
Okay. I wanted to mention something. I mean, this subject is so broad, you can't get everything in. There was an article I ran across, and I was intending to include that in tonight's discussion. So I do want to mention it. And for everyone that's listening, go to our website. That's www.cwertalknetwork.com, and I will post it there. Mm-hmm. But there is another group, and these are a group of white advocates in social media that intervene on behalf of Black people who are trying to defend ourselves on the media when we're attacked for our positions on various things. And they also have Black people that they work with when they get stumped and don't know how to intervene and respond to the white people. It was a great concept and great organization. All of the people are volunteers. They're vetted before they can become a part of the organization. And I did want to include that in tonight's program, but it's just so much we couldn't do that. But I did want to mention that. And I will post that to the website, that link about the organization. So anyone listening, just go to the website. I can't remember the name of that group, but I will post that onto the I've got it in one of my emails that I was intending to include in the program tonight. But I will post that information on our website, on our homepage. That's CWRTalkNetwork.com. That will be posted tomorrow.
Okay.
But now, another evidence of the current racial divide in America is the increase in hate crimes. The FBI defines a hate crime as a traditional offense like murder, arson, or vandalism with an added element of bias. According to recent FBI statistics, in 2016, there were 6,100 reported instances of people targeted based on their race, religion, sexuality, disability, or national origin, an increase of 300 over 2015. And like last year, the overwhelming majority of those victims were targeted because of their race or religion. Of the 4,496 targeted because of their race, 50.2% were Black or African American. Of the 1,583 targeted because of their religion, 55% were Jewish and 25% were Muslim. This is the second year in a row that hate crime numbers have increased, reversing the trend of the preceding 20 years. So, Chandra, do you have any idea what has caused this increase in hate crimes? And I think we both know the answer to that.
Yes, and we're going to go right back to the administration because, yeah, I mean, if you look at 2 years, okay, even though Trump has been in office for not even a year yet, but you think about campaign time before that, and that's usually a year before that. So you have campaign, you know, him campaigning, the Republicans campaigning, the conservative campaigning, and criminalizing our communities, criminalizing Black, Brown, Muslim, Jew communities, and everybody feeling threatened, or the powerful feeling threatened, the privileged feeling threatened. And now it's time, you know, now, I mean, they're saying that they're bad and they're criminalizing them. So now we're going to attack them because we can, because the people in power are saying that they're no good and they need to go back to their country or they're all bad people. So it must be okay for me to go and attack them because I've been wanting to do this for a long time already. You know, it's something that has been fueling, I think, during the whole Obama administration too, right? Because they were already mad that we had a Black president and that he was making changes and he was doing things for people of color and, you know, socioeconomic people on the lower level of the socioeconomic levels were getting more help and support. And they didn't like that. So that has been fueling for a long time, leading into campaign time and to the full year that Trump has been in office. So it makes sense that it's been on an increase in the last 2 years. And I think it's because of the leadership have been igniting and criminalizing our communities.
Okay. Now, interestingly, generally we associate hate crimes with violence, and we already got the FBI definition of what a hate crime is. But there are more subtle versions or types of hate crimes that are signals that those who commit them may resort to violence in the future. And here's one example of that. This is from Slate.com, November 13th of last year. And this happened at the University of Pennsylvania on November 11th of 2016. And this is what happened. Every black member of the University of Pennsylvania freshman class was apparently added to a racist social media group called Mud Men that was created using messaging app GroupMe. The anonymous group's creators then proceeded to announce an event called Daily Lynching for November 17th. It appears the messages were connected to a student, not from the University of Pennsylvania, but the University of Oklahoma, who was then suspended temporarily. So, Chandra, why should this type of activity be classified as a hate crime, and why is it so dangerous?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a hate crime because of the undertones of, you know, of really why that person made it, you know, and the name of it, and then it's giving a date on when they're going to do lynching, and so it's including. I mean, nowadays with Facebook groups or with any app, you can add people to a group, and they have no power over you adding them. So definitely a threat. You threaten my life. You're telling me my people are going to be lynched. So I definitely feel like it needs to be classified. And that person or that individual that started that group on that app should have been expelled. He should have went to jail, and he should have been charged with a hate crime. I don't know what happened in that case, but we've seen this time and time again that there's really no discipline. They get suspended, or they get, you know, I don't know what happened. What did you say happened to him?
The punishment was temporary suspension.
Temporary suspension. Yeah, temporary suspension. So he was able to come back to school and still continue on with his education and have all the privileges that he probably normally has. So definitely it's not taken seriously. It probably wasn't taken seriously as a hate crime. I don't know if he was charged with anything. But definitely I see it as a hate crime. You are threatening my people, my family. You're threatening these individuals that you added to this group. And I think any type of threat, any type of statement that is towards a hatred is a hate crime.
Okay, very good. Right now we're going to take a brief break, and we would like to hear your viewpoint on our conversation. Just give us a call at 563-999-3660. That number again is 563-999-3660. When you call, please remain on the line, and we will get to your call as soon as possible. That number again is 563-999-3660. If you have a question for our guest, author, speaker, and activist, Mrs. Chandra Brooks. By the way, when you call, you will be entered into our CWR Listener of the Month Appreciation Program, and you could win our monthly cash award. When we return, we will discuss more causes of racial hatred and divisiveness, including distrust and the opportunity gap. So please stay tuned.
This is the CWR Network, hashtag 1 million strong.
Their feed, they're super ugly. The things they say to them online are cruel and they're not true. So tell your friend, Know someone being bullied online? You can be a witness and make a difference by letting the world know it isn't cool and by letting your friend know you care. Learn more at eyewitnessbullying.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
1 in 3 adults in America have prediabetes, but most don't know it. To let people know it can be reversed before it becomes type 2 diabetes, professional basketball player Julius Randle is doing everything in reverse.
I'm only dunking with reverse windmills. I drove the whole way to practice in reverse. I don't recommend it. This move is called the reverse shuffle. I do recommend it. And it took me months to learn how to speak in reverse, like this. Here's 10 almost for diabetes type 2 with living Ben has mom my. In other words, my mom has been living with type 2 diabetes for almost 10 years. So together, we want to say to the 84 million Americans at risk, exercise and healthy eating can help reverse prediabetes. Start by taking a simple one-minute risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Bet he can't say that in reverse.
In 50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
My savings are gone.
Okay, where were they last?
Here, right before I spent them on that vacation to Aruba.
Weird. Not weird. Not saving now means no money later. For free ways to save, go to feedthepig.org. This message brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
This is the CWR Network, hashtag 1 million strong.
Welcome back. If you just joined us, this is Donnell Edwards Viewpoints, and our very special guest is author, speaker, and activist, Mrs. Chandra Brooks. Chandra, in recent years, the relationship between the police and the Black community and other communities of color has deteriorated, as well as the lack of trust that Blacks have in the government and the courts. How does this all factor into the racial hatred and divisiveness in the United States?
I think that our people have been dealing with this, I mean, from the beginning of the time, really. We've been dealing with police. Actually, the police were set up to, the authorities were set up to hunt down slaves. Right. And so this was kind of set up that way. And we had this kind of the divide from the beginning, and these feelings of distrust and this violence against Black and Latino communities with the police that have been unseen for so many years. And now with technology and smartphones, it's kind of really being put out there, to show the world that this has been happening for so long, and we've been telling you, and you haven't been paying attention, and you haven't justified it, or you have, kind of swept it under the rug for so long, but now you can't, because we have it documented, and we're showing you that this has been happening for so long. So I think that I don't think it's gone anywhere. I don't think it's gotten worse. I think it's just gotten publicized. And it's ignited, of course, just like the same issues that we've had in the last couple of years. And because of the rising of activism within people, within the communities of color, understanding our rights, really getting to the root and understanding policy and why the police are so protected. And why none of the police, the majority of the police officers do not get convicted when an armed Black male or Latino, individual is killed. So, I think this is something that has been fueled and has been ignited for a long time. It just has not been broadcasted like it is now.
Okay, following on those comments, and as you know, and as you mentioned, one of the major issues among African Americans as well as Latinos is the unprovoked killing of unarmed black males by police officers. At one point, seemed like this was almost a weekly occurrence. And they, as you mentioned, are usually not charged with the crime. They invoke the stand your ground rights or self-defense. And when they are charged, they are in, prosecuted in such a way that juries do not find them guilty of a crime. Now, I learned while researching for an earlier program, because this race in America, Where Do We Go From Here, is a series on our network. It's ongoing. And I learned from researching for an earlier program in the series that this is also the killing of males unprovoked who are unarmed occurs frequently in the Latino community, although it doesn't usually get as much coverage in the news. Now, there have also been women who have been killed in police custody under very questionable circumstances. And in your work with coalitions involving police misconduct, have you learned anything that may help eliminate this problem?
Yeah, it comes down to policy and the law within the state, because the states oversee the laws when it comes down to policing. And, I mean, we can yell at the current chief or whatever local police unit department, but they really have no power when it comes down to the policies that they are following. In regards to the way they react when they are threatened, to the way they're trained, to the way they're prosecuted. They're in California, and I can only speak on California law, there is a law called the Police Officers Bill of Rights. So they have Bill of Rights. They've had Bill of Rights that have been, you know, that were created centuries ago. And these are the policies and ideals that they still follow. So with the Police Officers Bill of Rights, they don't have, they can't go back into a police officer's file and see any bad behavior, any discipline, any issues that they've had in the past when it comes to a case that comes up. So say that they, you know, they are charged, or they're, you know, they're people, somebody's trying to charge them with either prosecute them with a killing, or being overly aggressive, or, you know, misconduct. They can't go back on their record. They can't look at their record. Their records are sealed. So that protects an officer. And, you know, they have a lot of authority to shoot and justification to shoot if they feel slightly threatened. And the problem with that, though, you know, we understand that I'm going to react if I'm threatened, right? You're going to react when you're threatened. But the problem with that is that we all have bias. We all have an internal bias and a bias that we, you know, are unaware of. And usually they're not trained in that. They don't understand that. And they react. And this is what we're calling for. We're calling for different laws and different training. So people understand what they're dealing with, because you're going to have maybe somebody who's never been around a black man or a Latino man their whole life, and say that you're a police officer and you're in a situation, and a dark skin black man is coming towards you, and you are scared for your life because all you've seen on television, in the media, and on radio is that they're scary, they're in gangs, and they're drug dealers. So you think that they're going to kill you. And this is a bias that you have. And so you're threatened, so you're quick to kill. Well, we need to figure out something about that. We need to do something about that, because we cannot have biased individuals on police departments that are killing based on an ideal or based on a stereotype that they have inside of them to shoot and kill because they feel threatened. Right away, not because the guy was threatening them. The guy could have just been walking peacefully, and a lot of that has happened. People have been sitting in their cars, been killed, have been moving, have been killed because of the color of their skin. So definitely comes down to policy, and it comes down to law, and it's something that ACLU has been working on. But actually, that whole coalition has been dismantled or kind of pushed to the side for some other things that have been going on. And it's really unfortunate because I wanted to really do some work on that police officer Bill of Rights and revise it. But it kind of got put on the back burner, and it's something that I can't carry alone. But it's definitely something on my radar and something I like to talk about because, you know, in California, it's a law. Can you imagine what the laws are protecting police officers in more conservative states? And I don't even know those laws, but just, you know, for people to think about that.
That's very interesting, that police officers' Bill of Rights. I'm not sure, but I think we have something like that here in my state also. But, you know, because of the ongoing epidemic of police officers killing unarmed black males, many who are young black males, some not even adults yet, it has been necessary for many years for black parents to take an unprecedented action to prepare and protect their male sons. Listen to the following audio clip from the PBS documentary, The Talk, and then we'll talk about this.
The Talk is the talk that black parents really have with their children about how to deal with any encounter with the police.
The Talk isn't something that just came about in the last couple of years. This is something that black parents have been having with their children for generations.
I did not expect him to ever be in trouble, but they don't have to be. They don't have to do anything, which is the problem.
Abdul was killed by these four officers, unarmed, with nothing more than his cell phone.
The Talk is a two-hour documentary looking at the different aspects of this whole issue that's become catastrophic in America today.
Sheriff's Office, how you feeling today? You all right?
Doing good, man, doing good.
I'd be burying my head in the sand to think that we don't have racism in law enforcement. It does exist, but that doesn't mean that we can't make efforts to eliminate racism.
We have two rights that even the President of the United States does not possess. We can take life, we can take liberty, and we must go under the highest level of scrutiny.
I am proud to say that I was a police officer. There may be cultural differences, but there cannot be reactions and enforcement models based upon race.
There were things that I needed to learn about as a white person.
Wake up. This affects us all.
I'm hopeful that The Talk will open the eyes of some of my brother and sister officers to stop with the us against them and realize that this problem affects my children and could actually affect their children.
That was an excerpt from the PBS documentary entitled The Talk, and for anyone that hasn't seen that, especially if you are a black or a Latino parent, I highly recommend it. Now, several of the people that you heard from that clip from the documentary were either current or former police officers who are concerned for their male sons. And this is a serious problem, and it's something that we need to do more than just talk about. Now, Chandra, I know part of your background is Latina. Do Latina parents also have this talk or take similar action with their male sons?
I don't think it's as prominent in the Latino community as it is in the African-American community, because I think of the tone of skin makes a huge difference. And I can tell you that my husband is a dark-skinned male, African-American male, and he has to put his glasses on because he works for AT&T. And he told me that. He's like, I put my glasses on when I have to walk up to a house and help them with their phone lines, because he's had customers get very threatened and scared when he walks up to their house. Definitely not something as prominent in the Latino community as it would in the African American community that I am aware of. But I do know that it's definitely a conversation that has to be had, because it is a huge problem. And you don't know the problem unless you deal with it. I don't think the numbers are as high in the Latino community as it is in the African American community, and that's why it's not as, you know, prominent and happening in the community, I mean, in the Latino community as in African American, because, you know, it's scary just to let your sons out the door if they're black, and you just never know because it's happened, you know. And I think on average, you know, just an African American male is stopped like once or twice a month, you know, just harassed or talked to, or, you know, just kind of targeted when they're out in the community. So it's definitely something that they deal with on a daily basis, and something that they feel threatened with every day. They never know. They don't know if it's going to happen. They don't know when it's going to happen, but they're used to it. And a lot of people are used to it. A lot of men are used to it. They're just like, this is just something that has been happening their whole life. And it's really disheartening, and it's really scary. And I think a lot of it has to do with us training and understanding our unconscious and conscious biases, just like the officers were stating, you know, a wake-up call to understand that. And some of it is ego and authority, right? One of the officers said, you know, we have the right to take liberty and what was it? Do you remember liberty and life? Exactly.
Yes.
So they have these rights and they have to take it very serious. So imagine putting that type of power in the hands of a, you know, person that is not very stable and that has biases, that has maybe some insecurities and is still threatened by people of color. You're putting that power in the hands of these individuals, and this is what happens. You know, our young men get harassed.
Okay. Now let's move on to another area. Another one mm-hmm. of the causes of the racial divide we see is the lack of economic opportunity for African Americans and the wage gap between African Americans and whites and Latinos and whites in America. Now, interestingly, an analysis of FBI and Southern Poverty Law Center data revealed one factor that stood out as a predictor of hate crimes and hate incidents in a given state, and that was income inequality. States with more inequality were more likely to have higher rates of hate incidents per capita. And also, in his article, Blacks and Latinos Will Be Broke in a Few Decades, in Fortune Magazine Online, dated September 19th of this year, Josh Hoxie, who is director of the Project on Opportunity and Taxation at the Institute for Policy Studies, states in a report that he co-authored entitled The Road to Zero Wealth. In that article, Mr. Hoxie states, the divide between the wealth of a typical black family and the typical white family today is vast. The median black family has just $1,700 in wealth. 30 years ago, that same family had $6,800 in today's dollars. Latino families at the median have similarly small assets, just $2,000, and also saw a decline over the past three decades. By 2053, just 10 years after the century is projected to become majority non-white, black median families will own zero wealth if current trends continue. 20 years later, Latino median families will follow suit. So, Chandra, how does the economics, the high unemployment rate in the black and Latino community, limited or no opportunity to improve the standard of living, and the growing wealth gap, how does all of this contribute to the current racial hatred and divisiveness in the United States?
Well, I think you'll see a definite trend in some of the, you know, states that are that where we see the most, right, the most racial discrimination and the racial divide and the hate crimes. You're going to see a trend in that where, like you just said, that's what they're saying, is that most of the Latino and African Americans are on the low on the totem pole when it comes to economic opportunity and unemployment. But it was set up that way. I mean, we were never set up to have the wealth. You know, they made the wealth on our backs, and they've been able to grow, and we've been able to just continue to be on the lower level of the socioeconomic totem pole, and we've never been able to given the opportunity to catch up. You know, we've always been trying to play catch up when it comes to different policies and different opportunities amongst the years. We've always been behind, so we haven't been able to catch up. And then when you have different policies and different administrations come in, it seems like we're getting ahead, and then it slows down. So I think that, you know, we are, you know, it comes right back to white privilege and the privileges that they've had, and this nation has contributed and supported for so many years that, you know, we have not been a priority. We have not been given the opportunities as white people have, and it's showing. You know, the numbers prove it. When it comes down to it, when we're looking at the numbers, we haven't been given that opportunity that white people have, and it's going to continue to grow like that unless we change policy. And also, you know, I think about media. You know, the media is feeding us, the music, the television, and everything is making us. Making our kids want to be drug dealers. You know, they want to look like thugs. They want to act like thugs. And, you know, it makes me really think about who's funding these media ideals and these messages that they're feeding to our children. And I think it's deeper than even me and what I can explain. But what I can say is that the trends make sense in hate crimes. You're going to see that huge gap probably more in the South, in southern states, where people don't come out of that hole and they stay there because it's been like that. It's just black and white. It's divide. You've had the families that have money for centuries and centuries, and they just help each other, and they fund each other's businesses, and they have each other's backs, and they started off on a better opportunity than we have. So of course they're going to be ahead centuries later, and things are not improving. And then you have the horrible music, you have the horrible media and television, and it continues. The trend continues.
Okay. Now, as most of you listening who are regular listeners to this program know, our Race in America, Where Do We Go From Here series is a special feature of my program, Donnell Edwards Viewpoints, excuse me, and the network, the CWR network. However, the purpose of the program is not to cause further division between races, but to get people talking about race with people of other racial or ethnic backgrounds. And that is what's lacking. That is one common thread in most of the discussions we have had with guests during this series, that we just don't talk about race in this country. So, Chandra, do you feel that a lack of constructive dialogue between blacks and whites and people of other racial, ethnic, or religious backgrounds would go a long way in improving race relations in America?
Yeah, I think it helps. I definitely think it helps. And I think action after that, those discussions help. And I think the people in power need to be at these discussions, because that's where it's going to change. And I think us making sure that we're at decision-making tables, so then we can be the change, and we can create the change. And that's exactly why I wrote my book, to make sure that we understand that we can preach and tell decision makers to make that change, but unless we are at the table, and we have the power to do that, things really won't change unless we're at the table. But I definitely believe that we have to have these conversations, and they do help, making them understand their privilege, and us understanding their viewpoints as well. Just like I mentioned earlier about white privilege, and if somebody doesn't know that they've had white privilege all their life, then, you know, we have to give them some time to get educated and understand that. And see it from our perspective, and vice versa. So I think there's several organizations that are doing good work on that. and opening eyes and trying to come, you know, meet in the middle. Definitely working with like the Women's March groups in different areas that are mostly led by white women that are rising up and that want to be allies and want to do something. And they're bringing in and they're trying to work with the communities of color to find some common ground and see how they can help and understand
okay.
their privilege and do the work that they need within their own communities.
Okay, very good. Now, just one final question. In your opinion, if the country does not change its current course of racism and hatred, what can we expect the outcome to be?
I think it's just going to get worse if we don't do something now. And I think that, you know, as people of color, we have to, just like I just said a second ago, we have to meet in the middle and we have to work with our white allies because we need each other and we have to come together and you know, sit at the table and figure out a plan and rise up together. Because if we don't, it's going to be too late if we don't do it now. I think now
okay.
is the time because we have so many white people and white allies that are rising up that want to, you know, be a part of the movement. And so this is more than we've had ever. So we have to understand that the majority of people in power right now are white. So we need our allies in order to rise up at the same time as we need to be taking our seats at decision-making tables and infiltrating the system and being the decision makers moving forward.
Okay. Thank you very much. I would like to leave everyone with this final thought for tonight, a positive thought that demonstrates that racism is a learned behavior. And since it is learned, it can also be reversed. Now, this is a true story. Years ago, about 17 years ago, to be exact, I developed a course for a seminar that I was conducting. And I ran across this, and it's always stayed with me. And one day, a white schoolboy came home and said to his mother, "I've made a new friend at school. May I bring him home to play?" "What color is he?" the mother inquired. "I can't remember. Tomorrow, I'll look and see." Chandra, thank you very much for being our guest this evening. We all benefited from your knowledge and experience. Thank you so much for coming. Now, your book, Black, Brown, and Political, Get Informed, Get Empowered, mm-hmm. and Change the Game, that's available on Amazon.com. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
And if our listeners want to get in contact with you to speak or to get more information, how can they contact you?
Well, they can find me on Facebook under Chandra Brooks and also visit my website at Chandra, Chandra-Brooks, Brooks.com.
Okay. All right. Very good. We thank you again. And we also thank all of you in our CWR Nation listening audience all over the world. Join us again next Monday at 6:30 p.m. when our guest will be author and speaker Eric Elliott. Mr. Elliott is the author of the book Onward to Manhood. He is firmly entrenched in manhood as a husband, father, son, brother, teacher, friend, impact speaker, and author. From each of those platforms, he's extended timeless encouragement to numerous friends and associates. We will be discussing how to reverse the trend of insignificant men, so we welcome you back to join us. Tonight, we are proud to introduce a new feature to our program as we close. Our social awareness song of the week. We feel that music is power. And this song really goes well with what we've been discussing tonight. And we leave you with tonight's, this week's selection, which is Honestly by phenomenal award-winning recording artist, Layla Hathaway. And although the song by itself is outstanding, we strongly encourage you to see the video, which includes events from Ferguson, Standing Rock, Colin Kaepernick and the NFL players protest, and Charlottesville. Ms. Hathaway says, and I'm quoting, "Honestly, it's a love song about love lost. I'm talking about falling out of love with America." although I still have hope in this country and I still want to dream, this video is meant to symbolize how this time has made so many of us wake up to the nightmare of this country and how we all just want the nightmare to end. End of quote. The video is available at our website, CWRTalkNetwork.com. Just click on the menu button on the homepage and then select videos from the menu. And right now, enjoy Honestly from Layla Hathaway as we close. And please join us for the next episode of Donnell Edwards Viewpoints next Monday.
You used to be my heartbeat. Your love was made for me. I could not live without you. You were my destiny. Now that my eyes are open, see how the tables turn. And now I'm not so sure. Call this a lesson learned.
This is the CWR Network, hashtag 1 million strong.